Good morning, and welcome to the October 21st, 2024 edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Roger.
We're going to start this morning by speaking with political consultant Reed Galen. He's going to be talking about the economics of political advertising, something all of us are seeing quite a bit of these days.
Then we'll be speaking with Megan Gorman about her new book, All the President's Money, How the Men Who Govern America Governed Their Money.
All this and more on Mountain Money. Stay tuned. There are many ways to tell that the seasons are changing. The trees are colorful. Walmart has put out the Halloween candy and even the Christmas lights. And in an election year like this, the airwaves are beginning to fill with political ads. So what are the underlying economics of political advertising? How do campaigns and outside groups decide on their messages and how to communicate them? And how do they decide how to place them in our complex media environment? We're very lucky to be joined this morning by Reed Galen, a longtime veteran of the political ad wars and a co-founder of the Lincoln Project. Good morning, Reed. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with some history. What did the basic political advertising playbook look like prior to the mid-1980s?
Well, again, I think that there were only three channels, so you didn't really have any place else to go. And the idea of political advertising was, you know, really in its infancy. I think that it started to become modern in 1964, the Barry Goldwater and LBJ race. For me, one of the hallmark ads, and I know we'll talk about this, was what's called the Daisy ad. It only ran one time on the air, and it's a little girl going one, two, three, four, and then this voice, this very deep voice, five, four, three, two, and then a mushroom cloud, right? And you see, like, Daisy's face is, like, blacked out and everything else. And it's like, you know, you can't afford to have Barry Goldwater in the White House. Scared the hell out of everybody. LBJ goes on to romp. And so I think that was probably the first modern political ad. And since then, you know, for as long as we've been doing this, you know, there may be one ad a cycle, maybe two ads a cycle that really do that. But for the most part, it's pablum. It's over-tested. It's underdone. You know, it used to be politics is an art and a science. The advertising piece of it was more of an art. The targeting was the science. Now it's just really how can we run as many gross rating points? How many times can we put it on cable? How many times can we put it on social media? And so it's really become commoditized. And I think we forget, too, that advertising is a tactic of a broader strategy. And oftentimes I think that campaigns old and new forget that. They think that an advertising campaign is the strategy, which, I mean, I guess the medium can be the message, but oftentimes these things are running in places that no one's ever going to see them or that, you know, even if people see them, they're not very good, they're not very interesting, or they've seen it so many times they tune it out.
Exactly. So prior to the 1980s, you know, obviously this one was, let's go back even further. Prior to the 1960, what, I mean, in the advent of television, when did political ads or presidential ads hit the air?
Yeah, it's funny. The last time we really had a look back at that was in Mad Men. Remember, because I believe it was the 1952 or 56 Eisenhower campaign that actually enlisted the guys on Madison Avenue to say, we need something that's going to reach out and touch people. And so that's the idea of like, okay, can you market a president like you can market a product? The answer back then was maybe yes, because I don't think we were really, I mean, you know, even just 8 years later, as we talked about in 64, it was different. But the difference between political advertising and marketing advertising is that if you say toothpaste A is good, right, you don't also say, and toothpaste B will make your teeth fall out, right? It's a little bit of a different dynamic.
So we're sort of moving into the realm of talking about negative advertising. I suppose the LBJ, Goldwater, Daisy ad was negative advertising. But probably the most famous negative advertising ad was the Willie Horton ad that Lee Atwater produced in the Bush campaign. Can you talk a little bit about that and its impact?
Yeah, I think it's also important to talk about Willie Horton in the context that the first version of that ad was not a Bush campaign ad. That was probably the first for lack of a better way to put it, independent expenditure ad. Then the Bush campaign, I believe, did a version of its own. But that was one in which, remember, that he's running against Governor Michael Dukakis of Massachusetts. He'd had a furlough program for state prisons. Willie Horton, I believe, had been a convicted murderer, rapist, African-American. And he was let out on a furlough and committed murder again. And it went to the whole idea that Michael Dukakis was not going to keep you or your family safe. No, yes, just another Northeastern liberal. Dukakis didn't do himself any favors in the debate of that year. He also didn't do himself any favors with wearing a big goofy helmet on a tank, which a friend of mine actually produced that event, and it is the thing that he will take to his grave with him. But I think it was very effective for its time.
And it did set up sort of this increasing cycle of trying to find, you know, really negative things to say about your opposition in advertising.
Yes, as humans in general, and as Americans in particular, we believe it. You know, all these polls and focus groups that say, oh, I don't like negative advertising, that's horse hockey. Americans love negative advertising because they believe it. Yes. Now, we have done some incredibly cinematic ads that I think are really beautiful, and I think some of the positive stuff that the Lincoln Project has done is better than any of the negative stuff we ever did. But the truth is that if it bleeds, it leads, and political advertising is no different.
So, you know, let's talk a little bit about the sort of business, the infrastructure, the financial infrastructure of the political advertising world. Who are the major players and how do they make money?
Well, in a campaign year, especially a presidential campaign year, there's lots of people making money. If you start at the top, let's start with a presidential campaign. I think in the last 90 days or so, Kamala Harris's campaign has raised $1 billion with a B dollars. The vast majority of that will go to advertising of one kind or another. Obviously, there are a lot more ways to spend that money now than there used to be. But they will say, okay, look, we need certain states, right? So in this year, it's Arizona, Nevada, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Georgia, North Carolina. They will probably run national ad buys too. You know, the Trump campaign has been running national advertising during football, both college and pro. And then most often what you will do is you say, we're going to advertise in Pennsylvania, right? Well, are we going to spend money in the Pennsylvania media market, in the Harrisburg media market, in the Pittsburgh media market, maybe all three? What are the different demographics of a particular channel that we're looking for, or cable outlet? Then you layer in maybe radio, which is still used, but not as much. And then digital advertising, which could be Google search ads or could be YouTube ads. Look, if I have your cell phone number, I can send as many ads to you directly as I want. So this has also gotten very precise. I think the issue is that the precision and the art of the two things do not always match up. Now let's talk about the money. The people who make the most money are the consultants, right? They take somewhere between 10 and 15% off the top. The media buyer, that's the middleman, somewhere between 2 and 3%. And then the local sales guys. So if you live in Ottumwa, Iowa, right, and you're just, you know, they're just dumping money onto your station like you're going on vacation for the next 12 months because you're making more money than you could possibly imagine. Remember, too, the candidates get a massive discount on the rate. They get the lowest possible rate available to them. But outside committees, super PACs, don't. They have to pay the highest possible rate. So local television stations will always preempt a Tide ad or whatever, which is why you see so many commercials, because the stations are making a mint on this. The problem is, too, though, and this goes to the strategy side, is that because there are so many people within the campaign infrastructure making money, it has skewed the idea that broadcast television or cable television is still a great way to advertise. Now, there are still more people watching ABC, CBS, NBC, probably on any given moment than anything else, but it's a very broad swath. It's probably older. You can't really target it that well. And so the financial aspects of it skew to where can we make the most money rather than what's the most effective.
That's really interesting. I was trying to visualize how the decisions get made and by whom. Mm. In other words, you talked a little about art and science. In the Trump campaign, there's 3 weeks to go. How am I going to identify... I mean, obviously, a lot of decisions have already been made, mm-hmm. right? Time has already been booked, but I can change what I'm going to air.
Sure,
that
right.
Time.
Yeah, you can change traffic.
So how am I? How is that decision being made? What kinds of tools are they using to try to maximize the value of what they're doing?
Well, you know, there's always polling, right? And the way that most people still make ads is we're going to run a poll. We're going to see what five issues the people in this survey care most about. Then we're going to create an ad. Then we're going to show it to a focus group. Then we're going to make some changes. Then we're going to test it to within an inch of its life on Facebook or someplace else. This is really more Democrats than Republicans. We're going to shave off any sharp edge that could possibly make it memorable, and then we're going to put $10 million behind it. Republicans are a little bit different, which is Republicans want to be transgressive. They want the attention because what we, and as a former Republican, what I understood is like, if something is boring, people will go buy it. If something mm-hmm. is eye-catching or upsetting, you're going to pay attention to it. And right now, the Trump campaign has put millions and millions of dollars behind an ad in which there's footage of Vice President Harris, I think in 2019, speaking to an interviewer about the idea of people in prison getting sex change operations. And the closing line of the spot is, Kamala Harris is for they, them. Donald Trump is for you. Now, as odious as I think Donald Trump is, and as odious as I think that ad is, that is a good ad. That is an ad that's going to get attention because it's aimed at middle-aged white guys, right? It's aimed at middle-aged black and Latino guys, too, because that's a value proposition. And the value proposition is, does Kamala Harris believe in the same America that you do, or does Donald Trump? And that is a very good ad. And the guy who made that ad is a guy named Chris LaCivita, going back to advertising, whose most famous thing up to now was he was the guy who created the Swift Boat ad in 2004 that uh-huh. basically sunk John Kerry's campaign for a total ad buy of $186,000.
The Swift Boat ad campaign was only that small a buy.
Yeah, and it wasn't a Bush campaign ad. It was an outside group.
Other ads that you were finding particularly intriguing this cycle?
You know, that was the one that's caught the attention the most.
Any that you think are falling flat? I mean, some of the ads are just pretty pictures, and I'm not quite sure what they're trying to accomplish.
Well, that's because, again, you see in a situation, let's be clear, like the Harris campaign has existed for less than 4 months.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So they had to go from being the vice president who was going to go to all these second and third tier markets and not be in advertising to being the top of the ticket trying to figure out what to do. And so, again, I think I love my Democratic friends. The problem is that they're often like doctors when it comes to advertising and strategy, which is like first do no harm. And I think the other part that anybody running against Donald Trump suffers from is that he has what I call the discount rate, which is he's been a jerk in the public space for 50 years. So anything mm-hmm. you say about him isn't going to be a surprise, right? Anything you might say, look, do you know he said this? They're like, I didn't, but I'm not really shocked by it because he says this kind of stuff all the time. So that's what's really tough about him. So what I would have done if I were the Harris campaign was I would have continued to run ads about the fact that his crowd sizes are small, that people keep leaving, because that gets in his head. Running against Donald Trump is not like running against another candidate. It's not an issue proposition. It's all about making him do the things that he wants to do and forcing him to do that, like she did in that debate when she's mm-hmm. like, I don't know why, Donald, people keep leaving. And you saw he tried to hold it together for about 30 seconds, and then he couldn't help it. And that was the rest of it. But that was exactly the kind of stuff they should do. That's the kind of stuff that we did. You know, we call it the audience of one. Like, Donald Trump is always at home. He doesn't have friends. He's always at home at night watching Fox News. That's what we did in 2020. He's sitting in the residence of the White House. We could advertise on Fox News in the Washington, D.C. market, not nationally, just that market, where we know it's going to go to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and talk to him because he is like the cable guy. What he sees on television, to him, is reality.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Now, they are running... I did see an ad the Harris campaign ran recently of former Trump senior officials mm-hmm. Saying critical things about him. Is that an effective strategy?
I think it's something that they need to do. Mm-hmm. I think it's something that they need to do because there probably are, I would say, somewhere between at this point now, probably 7 in 10% of Republican voters who really don't want to vote for Donald Trump, they're not ever going to vote for Kamala Harris. So, and we've been working on this too, is you just need to keep them away from Trump because his coalition is 90% white. It's smaller than it was 4 or 8 years ago. And so he can't survive an undervote. He can't survive any one person not turning out for him, which is what we saw cost him Wisconsin in 2020 and Georgia in 2020. It's a good strategy. It is one that is, again, that's not talking to Democrats. That's talking to independents and Republicans.
Now, is anybody doing newspaper ads? I mean,
are there newspapers?
Yeah. Well, that's part of the issue is there's not too many newspapers left. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, are there
or print generally?
Yeah. Any kind of print. I mean, does it work?
You know, if you're at this point, if you're running print ads, it's because you have no place else to spend money.
Oh. Okay.
Not because you think there's anything particularly effective. It's just because, you know, to your point, like how many people read physical newspapers, right? Outside. You know, if you live in a big city, maybe you still get it. You read the sports page, right? But the chances of you seeing a full-page ad for Harris or Trump, again, maybe they're running it, but I don't know that they're counting on that making a difference.
Let's talk about independent groups. Obviously, you know, the Lincoln Project is an independent group. Right. There are other independent groups out there. How significant are they in this cycle, as best you can see? Are they spending money? Are they active?
Oh, yeah, outside groups will spend hundreds of millions, if not a billion plus dollars. The issue, there's two issues. One is that, you know, you're not technically allowed or legally allowed to coordinate. So a third party group can't talk to the campaign. The campaign can telegraph, like, here are the things we're interested in. And then the third party group can go out and do that stuff. But for the most part, they have to be, you know, again, we call it a firewall between them. And so I think they can have an outsize effect, but again, I think it's just like, let's go back to the Republican primary, such as it was. Ron DeSantis had all this money. And I remember my co-founder Rick Wilson and I doing an editorial board at the New York Times 2 years ago almost, or late 2022. And this guy is not gonna win. He's not gonna win anything. Like, we've seen enough of these guys to know. But he's got all this money. Like, he could have $1 billion and it wouldn't matter. And I think that's one important thing for everybody to understand is money in politics buys you options. It doesn't buy you victory. It just says, I have all this money now. What can I do with it? It's better to have more money than less money. Mm-hmm. But if you have a bad product, right, in a Ron DeSantis or another candidate.
Or Phil Graham
or Jeb Bush, right? It doesn't matter. And so all of this money is fine. But as I said, there's a higher rate for how much it costs to put a spot on the air. And you have to sort of guess if it's early on what the candidate or the campaign wants. And now it's like, again, everything is so saturated. You know, everybody's like, well, I don't want to not do it. Because what if I didn't spend this last $15 million and Harris or Trump loses by half a point somewhere?
And with these independent groups, are many of them funded by a very small number of very wealthy people? Are they basically, you know, William Randolph Hearst-like megaphones that people are buying?
I would say that William Randolph Hearst have their own megaphones, which are the media outlets they own. I mean, Rupert Murdoch would be the modern example
true,
of that.
True, that's true.
But yes, typically they are funded by very wealthy individuals who are giving multiple 7 figures, sometimes 8 figures, to these kinds of committees, with the idea that the people who are getting the money are, you know, sort of, they have the imprimatur of the campaign or the candidate. And again, you know, it happens year in and year out. They'll all come up with some, again, testing regimen to say, look, we tested this, it worked well. Did you win? Yes, see, it worked. Did you lose? Well, we tested it. Right. So it's also, from my perspective, and I've been doing this a long time, it's also a giant CYA operation. Right.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and we never test our ads. Right. You don't test your ads. No. Because from our perspective, we are trying to make an emotional appeal. We want people to emote when they see them, either happiness, sadness, fear, anger, whatever the case might be. And again, politics is an emotional business. We wrap rationality around it to make sense of our choices. But it's an emotional business.
One thing happened a couple of weeks ago, and I can't remember what it was. There was an incident that happened, and somebody cut an ad within 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember. Somebody said something. I can't remember what exactly what it was. How do they do that? How do you manage to put an operation together that can react that quickly?
Well, you know, we used to have what are called war rooms, where there would be just 25 kids sitting literally in a giant room, either watching all three cable networks and all the broadcast networks and being online all the time. I assume they still have that. It's probably far more efficient now than it was. But I'll say this, is that the ability to produce an ad is so much easier. I mean, it used to be it was on film. Mm-hmm. You had to have a big editing bay. It took days to do color correction and sound and all that other stuff. Now a 24-year-old can crank it out in 90 minutes. Because, I mean, my daughter, who's here at Treasure, is in a filmmaking class, right? Like, they learn how to do this stuff, many of them on their own, and they're completely online as far as their generation's concerned, so a lot of it's intuitive.
Have you got her making ads yet?
They have both made ads, yes. My older one made an ad for when Taylor Swift endorsed Kamala Harris,
mm-hmm.
And my younger one has made one as well, yeah. I'm not sure I need to hire anybody. I've got my own production team in the house.
Okay, anything we should expect in the next couple of weeks that are different? What do you think is going to happen between now and the election with respect to advertising and publicity?
I think you'll see more of it. I think you'll see, especially from the Trump people, probably more unhinged advertising. Trump is unhinged as a rule. So I think that if the Democrats and the Harris campaign really want to start... Look, if anybody says they're undecided at this point, like, I don't know what kind of hole they're living in. But, you know, it's mm-hmm. maybe it's the bomb shelter their mom or dad built for them in the 50s. But I think that the noise is going to go up and all the attendant attention, activity, ugliness is going to ramp up, too. It's going to be a very rough last couple of weeks. As soon as those polls close, or even maybe a little bit before, you're going to start to see all sorts of mis and disinformation mm-hmm. showing up. This batch of ballots in a van didn't make it, or, you know, look what's happening. And the truth is, it's all going to be fake. Their idea is not to say, okay, Roger voted for Donald Trump and they switched it to Kamala Harris. The idea is to create enough confusion to say, well, how could we know who really won, so that they can then continue the process. And remember, these are learning creatures. What we saw post-2020, they will have learned, and they mm-hmm. have already had people on the ground. And, you know, this is why, again, I'm not a Democrat, I'm not going to be, but January 6th, again, will be the day that Congress certifies that. If Democrats have held the House because they'll be sworn in on January 3rd, the president, whether it's Harris or Trump, will be certified. If it's a Republican Congress, whether it's Harris or Trump, Trump would be certified, but Harris might not be. And so we're just in an unprecedented time, and what I would say is that, like, the next 2 weeks are just the next 2 weeks, and then we got the 10 weeks after that.
So basically, fasten your seatbelts, put on a crash helmet, and
yes.
Here we go.
And look, and there's nobody more than me who wants this race to be over,
yeah,
both literally and figuratively.
I'll bet.
Okay, we've been speaking with Reed Galen. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
No, thanks for having me, guys.
We'll be right back after this. Good morning. U.S. presidents are not only political figures tasked with the heavy burdens of domestic and foreign policy. They're also men, at least so far, who have personal finances to manage both before and after their presidencies. So what do we know about how presidents were, and in some cases were not, able to build wealth? And what lessons can we learn for our own financial health from the presidents? Author and financial planner Megan Gorman looked at various presidents from this unusual perspective in her new book, All the President's Money: How the Men Who Governed America Governed Their Money. We're lucky to be joined by her this morning. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money. Megan, are you with us?
I am. How are you doing today?
Well, we've overcome our first obstacle of the day, and we're really glad to have you with us. Megan, what motivated you to write this book, and how long did it take you to do the research?
Okay, so first of all, I've always loved the presidents. And I will tell you that... you know, one of the things that motivated me was that I was really, really, really focused on making sure I got the history right. And so I'd read about the presidents for years. But I also worked with wealthy people for my whole career. And I was always fascinated by the traits and skills they had in building wealth. And so what I wanted to do was sort of talk about those traits and skills that I see my clients have, but do it in a way where I could talk about the president. And that's what made it so much fun. And what I found was that most of the presidents were just like us.
In what sense?
Well, they're up late at night worried about money. They're struggling to budget. They're constantly trying to figure out what works and what doesn't work. And what you found is that a lot of the same issues that we face today, education, the cost of housing, how to make your budget work, this is stuff that people have been dealing with since George Washington. And that's what made it so incredibly human with the presidents, is the fact that they're really struggling with the same issues that we have.
You know, it's funny. Some presidents known for their brilliance were notoriously bad with money. I want to talk about Thomas Jefferson. He's a guy who comes from a wealthy background, but he managed to create significant financial challenges throughout his life. Can you share a bit about why?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because you think of Thomas Jefferson, you think this guy must have done everything in his life perfect. And trust me, with the exception of money, he was a pretty interesting guy. Now, remember, at that time, and this is true of Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, Washington, these Southerners owned a lot of land, and they were incredibly illiquid. And remember, they were also slaveholders, which is reprehensible. But what Jefferson was always unable to do was he was always unable to be present with his money. And what I mean by that is he was not really able to think about the consequences of not being able to make a decision. And so by being illiquid, rather than being like George Washington, who worked hard at trying to figure out ways of getting liquidity, Jefferson just sort of pushed it off, didn't really focus on it, and was always looking to buy stuff on credit. And the other thing is, because he was seen as wealthy, people often asked him if they would lend him money. And so what you find over the course of Jefferson's life is someone who's consistently pushing everything off till tomorrow, and it finally catches up with him. Because remember, in Jefferson's day, people lived to like 40, 50 years old. He lived well into his 80s. He's not expecting to have to make the money last that long. And at the end of his life, and this is incredibly shocking, he had to put Monticello up for auction. And it appeared in the newspapers, and people bought tickets. And it was going along, and finally a group of Americans got together, and they said, Thomas, you know, not a very good look. And they convinced him not to do the auction, that they would help him. But help never really came. And what's very, very striking is when you go through the letters of Thomas Jefferson, you know, one of the last letters at the end of his life is a beautiful treatise on democracy. But the second to last letter was basically asking to buy wine on credit. So learning how to say no would have been a great thing for Thomas Jefferson and his finances.
Yeah, wine seemed to be a repeated theme in your discussion of Jefferson. The guy seemed to really want to spend a lot of money on wine throughout his life, even when it made no sense.
Right, but we all know people like this today, right? We all know people who you're going, wait a minute, you're struggling, and yet you're all buying this. And one of the letters I found from the Lyndon Johnson Library was a letter from the early 40s. And Johnson's writing a friend, and he's saying, I waked up at 2 a.m. worried about money. And it's such a human experience, right? I'm up at 2 a.m. worried about money. But then in the next paragraph, he's talking about buying a suit that would be the equivalent of going and buying a $4,000 or $5,000 suit today. So we're all like these guys in that way, you know, struggling with our instincts and our human nature on what we want to spend money on.
Now let's take a peek at Herbert Hoover. Now, he did not come from money and is mostly associated with the financial disaster of the Depression. But his own career, in fact, reflects great financial acumen starting in college. How did he end up running mines around the world?
Yeah, so Herbert Hoover, a great American success story, the worst 4 years of his life, he's president. But if we take that out and we look at how he managed money, all Americans should aspire to be a Hoover. Now, he's an orphan in Iowa, and he's a Quaker. And the Quakers teach him to budget as a very young child in order to submit these budgets to court to get access to his inheritance. And so, you know, he makes his way to Stanford, is a member of the first class of Stanford, and the tuition was free. But Hoover had to work the whole time because, you know, the cost of living, housing, eating at Stanford costs money. But he gets out of college, and the panic of 1893 is still reverberating across the country. And he can't get a job, and he has a degree in mining and geology. And so Hoover eventually decides that what he's going to do is he's going to go to the Sierra Nevada and learn about mining from the ground up. And so he goes there, and he gets a job in a mine, pushing a cart at $2 a day all around. And the miners are looking at him like, who's this college kid here? What's he doing here? But he wins them over because he's a hard worker, and they teach him some of the secrets that they know about mines. Fast forward, he eventually gets a job in his industry, and they send him to Australia to manage mines. Mm-hmm. And he's really good because he's a good budgeter. And he's good at sort of doing cost reduction at these mines and making them profitable. And one day he's out. And mind you, in Australia, to get around at this time, he's on a camel. And it's miserable. It's hard, hard work. Not glamorous. Nothing easy about it at all. But he's making more than he would in the U.S. But he's out on his camel one day, and he sees a mine that's been abandoned. And rumor always had it that it had gold. And between his budgeting skills and the fact that he had gone into those mines in the Sierra Nevada, he does a whole study, and he determines this mine has money. And he writes his bosses. He says, I want you to buy this for $250,000, and I want you to put me in charge of it. And they do. And he hits gold. And this mine, the Sons of Gwalia, throws off gold for 60 years. They get over $50 million out of the mine. And Hoover gets a small ownership interest, and he's able to parlay this into great wealth. But the thing I have to tell you is, wealth is not just about having money. And for Hoover, wealth was about also helping his friends and his family and ultimately charity. And you see this in his letters. He talks about this to his friend back in America when he sends money home. He's like, look, save my money, but if my siblings or our friends from Stanford need money, just give them some, but don't tell them it's from me. And I think that's very powerful because I get asked all the time, who's the wealthiest of the presidents? And that's so subjective, right? Are you talking about in pure dollars? Are you talking about satisfaction with money and how you move it in the world? And so Hoover is one of those inspirational people with money that we really should embrace for the model that he shows that things like budgeting are incredibly important.
And you talk about, in the book, you talk about concepts like financial anxiety and financial well-being. And I guess Hoover represents someone who has financial well-being because he's backed himself up with different assets and is sort of matched his spending to his wealth.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes, but keep in mind, that doesn't mean he wasn't anxious. Mm-hmm. It was just that he was very good at working through his anxiety. And, you know, anyone who is proficient in money will often tell you, budgeting, well, it's a arduous, boring task that we all must do, It's really good for anxiety. It really helps calm you down because you're controlling the controllable.
Yes, yes. Well, another phenomenon that we all see in our day-to-day lives are couples, where there is tension between the couples over the handling of money. So with that, let's talk about Abraham Lincoln.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, yes, yes. I know. Poor Abe. He did so well in so many parts. And then his wife, they just weren't well matched, right? And this is important because financial values in a marriage really drive success. A CEO once told me the two ways to have success, there's two things you must do in life to have success. One is do something you love, and two, marry the right person. And poor Abraham Lincoln married someone who in some ways did help him career-wise, but in other ways really undermined him financially. So Lincoln had failed a lot with money, but by the time he got to Springfield, Illinois, he was an up-and-coming attorney. He falls in love with Mary Todd, who's from a wealthy family. And while they have a lot of the same political interests, financially, not so much. And she's living in this beautiful house in Springfield. Her sister is married to the governor of Illinois' son. She's got servants. She's wealthy. She marries Lincoln, and he moves her into a boarding house for $4 a month. So this is a disaster. I mean, she doesn't even have a drawing room to receive people in. But eventually, her father steps in and helps Abe out a little bit. And he's doing okay with money. And they're able to buy this beautiful house in Springfield in about 1844 for about $1,500. And they do well. But they do well in the sense that Abe's making money and Mary's running around run around town spending it. And Abe would go around and pay her bills off. And this continues when they get in the White House. So when they left for the White House, Abe was worth about $15,000. And that's probably about $400,000 in our money today. In the White House, he's making more money than ever before, and he saved every paycheck. He is putting it in U.S. Treasury bonds and Treasury notes that have been issued for the Civil War. And by the way, they're paying like 6 and 7%. And Mary's on her way to New York, and she's shopping. She's buying furs. She's buying 20 pairs of gloves at a clip. She's buying, you know, household plates and so on. And the press is having a field day. And it gets to the point that Mary tells Mrs. Keckley, her dressmaker, during Lincoln's election in 1864, I need him to win, because if he doesn't, he's going to find out how much debt we're in. Now, of course, tragically, we all know what happens with Abraham Lincoln. And as a side note, all of the presidents are paid through the end of the day, even when they're assassinated. Lincoln, McKinley, Garfield, Kennedy, all were paid through the end of their day. But when Lincoln dies, he has $85,000. That's $2 million in today's buying power, and no estate plan. And it's tragic, right? Somebody who had saved all this money. And he ends up, the family has to ask the Chief Justice of the United States to come in and help with the money. And Mary, because there's no estate plan, she only gets a third of the estate. Tad gets a third, and Robert Todd Lincoln gets a third. So Lincoln is a good example of someone who, if he had married someone who was really good with money or at least had the same financial values, he might have had more money. You know, you think of people like Lyndon Johnson and Lady Bird, very aligned financially. You know, if they had had a marriage more like that, the Lincolns probably would have had more money. But you know what? Good on Lincoln. Great American success story. And he learned a lot about money over the course of his life.
Okay, so now what? Which president would have matched with Mary Todd as far as their spendthrift lifestyles?
You know, I don't know if anyone could have been matched well with her, right? So historians always try to diagnose her. What I would tell you is this. The Lincolns would have been well served by having a financial planner or a tax attorney or a CPA who sat down with them and talked about these financial infidelities. Oftentimes, talk therapy works very, very well. I will tell you, the one president who couldn't have been married to Mary Todd would have been Ronald Reagan. Reagan would have went nuts because he was such a budgeter. And, you know, Reagan grew up poor, son of an alcoholic, but he's a really active budgeter over the course of his life. And one of the biggest tensions with his first wife, Jane Wyman, is that Jane, even though she grew up poor and they had some of the same values, she was a spender like Mary Todd Lincoln as well. So, again, you know, these people who spend, if they're not willing to work on it, it's really hard to be married to them.
That sort of reminds me of another piece of financial advice I've heard, which is to marry the second wife first. Anyway.
well, Nancy Reagan was a great financial match for
exactly.
Ronald. And I do, she was into budgeting. She understood that you had to delay gratification. They were very, very partnered. And that was one of the dynamics that, if you think about it, that helps create a successful marriage.
Yes.
They saw eye to eye on money.
You know, we're now accustomed to the notion that former presidents can easily achieve financial success post-presidency through books and speaking deals and the like. But that hasn't always been the case. When and how did that change?
You know, it's funny because it used to be you finished the presidency, you went back to, like, practicing law or farming, you wrote a book or you died, right? George Washington dies within 2 years of leaving the presidency. But Gerry Ford is an interesting character in history. And when he leaves the White House after 2 years, he's a little frustrated because most of the presidents will tell you it takes 2 years to figure out the job. So now, you know, he's just figured out the job and he's got to leave. And he's young. He's like 62. And he's like, what am I going to do, golf all day? And Ford, over the course of his life, always made sort of contrarian decisions with money. And so he hires a Hollywood agent, a gentleman by the name of Norm Brokaw, who he had gotten to know during the inauguration because there were so many events. And Brokaw and him decide, we're going to have sort of a three-prong approach. We're going to do a book deal, and they do a book deal. It's the first joint book deal with a first lady, so good on Betty. We're going to do speaking engagements. And then we're going to have this category called entrepreneurial endeavors. And it really, you know, Ford, of course, up until 1980, and most Americans forget this, there was a chance he was going to run again in 1980. In fact, there was the talk of him being a co-president with Reagan in 1980, which is wild. But after the 1980 election, Ford really embarks on all of this. But one of the things he does in this is he makes one mistake. Early in this, he decides he's going to endorse medals from the Franklin Mint. Now, today, the Franklin Mint is like the world of kitsch, right? But at that time period, you know, people seriously thought that if you invested in these medals and objects from the Franklin Mint, they would increase in value. So Ford does this set of medals, and he gets blowback. People are like, how tacky. And one newspaper even said, doesn't Gerald Ford realize he's lucky that without having become the president, nobody would have wanted his memoirs, much less these medals. So Ford backs away from those sort of product-type endorsements, and he decides to go on corporate boards, where he's a huge success. And even Sandy Wheel of Smith Barney says, you know, it's a brilliant idea to have a former president on your board. They see the world so differently. And Ford sort of changes this sort of mold. And Carter, by the way, when he finishes the president, makes presidency, he makes sure to say, I'm not going to be like Ford. But as you look on, you know, the Clintons, particularly Bill Clinton, the idea of speaking engagements, he really embraced that. The Obamas have built a media company. And so what you're seeing is with post-presidential money, Americans are a lot more tolerant. Where Americans struggle is where the conflict of interest is when they're still running for office or they're in office. So there's that fine line. And most of the time, most of the presidents keep it relatively tasteful.
Now, did any presidents leave the White House in worse financial condition than when they became president?
Oh, God, yes. Numerous ones did. Hmm. Numerous ones did. You know, you think about James Madison, right? You know, he's Jefferson and Monroe all really helped shape the ideas of this country. But Madison had a plantation that always struggled to have a thriving crop. And when he married Dolly, Dolly had a son from her first marriage who unfortunately struggled with addiction. And so over the course of his post-presidential life, he really struggled to have liquidity, to have financial success, to the point where he had to make decisions to work on his papers and get them organized so that he could sell them to help Dolly when he passed away. And you think about this, James Monroe, very similarly as well. So post-presidential life was not always lucrative, and the presidents today should always tip their hat to Gerry Ford because he changed it, and he really made it possible to have financial success. And by the way, when we look at Jefferson, we really don't want them selling their assets like that when they're post-presidential. We want them to have that sort of sheen on them that makes them, you know, a respected member of the American community.
You know, we talked about people like Lyndon Johnson, who obviously had concerns about money. Can we contrast that with Woodrow Wilson, a guy who's a president whose reputation has taken some hits lately, but he had some interesting attitudes about money.
He did. You know, how you're brought up really impacts how you feel about money. And Wilson was the son of a preacher. And he goes to law school, and he moves to Atlanta right out of law school. And this is right after the Civil War. Atlanta is booming. You know, you could plant a penny and grow a money tree. It was not hard to be profitable in Atlanta. But when you're a young attorney, your job is to do things like collect fees, right, and do the grunt work. And Wilson sort of put his nose up at this. In fact, he decided to go out on his own and start his own law firm. And he and his business partner in the firm, you know, both of them just didn't want to do the hard work required to build a profitable law firm. In fact, one story I read, they're there reading poetry to each other. So Wilson wasn't built for that, you know, sort of drive and ambitious type of career path like law or investment banking where you got to put in the grueling hours. He was very much, you know, holier than thou. And he eventually makes his way into academia, which was probably a better fit for him. But here's what's fascinating. At the end of his life, at the end of William Howard Taft's term, when he's leaving the White House, he writes Wilson this letter. And it's sort of like, hey, listen, let me tell you how you make money when you're a president. And Taft tells them, look, I saved $100,000 over the course of my presidency because they'll cover this, they won't cover that, but take advantage of this. And Wilson takes Taft's advice to heart. And by the end of his 2 years, he saved $250,000. Now, keep in mind, Wilson doesn't live long after the presidency, and he's very sick, but he does eventually find a way to have some savings. But his attitudes as a young man really sort of kept him from making it big at a time in Atlanta when people were really, really becoming able to have money and be profitable. He was no George Washington or Herbert Hoover, to say the least.
Okay, so speaking of George Washington, how did he accumulate wealth?
Okay, so George Washington is the ultimate hustler. Now, you have to put a little asterisk because he was a slaveholder, and he knew it was wrong, and he didn't do the right thing. So I don't want to espouse that part of Washington's story. But Washington was awesome, and we think of him as this older man, very stern and stoic. But as a kid, right, his father, he was the second son in his father's second marriage. So when his dad dies, his brother Augustine from the first marriage inherits everything. And poor Washington doesn't even get college. His father doesn't even mention that in the estate plan, which when you think about it, Washington hung out with Jefferson and Monroe and Madison, Adams, all very well-educated men. It was probably very difficult. But Washington was really hardworking, and he had a neighbor, George Fairfax, of the Fairfaxes of Virginia, who gave him a book on surveying and took him out to go surveying. And Washington learns to survey, and at the same time, as part of surveying, learns to budget. And Washington's an amazing budgeter. In fact, if you ever get a chance, go look at his budgets because they're stunning. And he learns this, and he starts to buy land. He's really, really starting to acquire assets this way slowly. He gets named the surveyor for different towns and counties. And then he does something that starts a trend with all future presidents. He marries up. And this is unbelievable. So many of our presidents married women wealthier than them. And he marries the widow Martha Custis. And by all accounts, she's beautiful. I mean, he's 6'2", very good looking in a time when men were like 5'6". So he stood out when he walked into a room. And by all accounts, it's this love match. But she comes with all of these assets. And so he becomes almost overnight one of the wealthiest men in the country. But it doesn't mean he's not money savvy. So I'll tell you, when he became the commander of the Continental Army, he says to Congress, look, you don't have to pay me. You just have to reimburse me my expenses. And little does Congress realize, this is a guy who's a hell of a budgeter. And at the end of the war, you know, 8 years later, he hands his budget in. They owe him $160,000. And he has all the receipts. So you see this with Washington again and again, somebody who uses, learns skills and then uses to maximize them to get to the next level. And when he dies, his estate's worth about, he thought it was worth about $600,000. At the time, they said it was about $750,000. But to give context, that was almost $400 million. And it's because he owned 52,000 acres around the United States. And people say, well, is he the wealthiest? And I would tell you, from a technical standpoint, yes, because his net worth at the time of his death was roughly 20% of 1% of the GDP of the U.S. at the time. So knock your socks off.
Yeah.
So, you know, people say, who do you want to emulate? You hear something similar with both Hoover and Washington. Budgeting, learning how to budget and using it, and then don't be afraid to work your butt off. Because both of them worked hard.
We've only got about 2 minutes left, but I do want you to talk a little bit about the mistake that Washington made with respect to his estate plan.
Yeah, so Washington, very smart man, and in that time, he had been executor of a lot of estates. Estate planning, because people didn't live a long time. People lived with a lot of estate planning, and when you had that much land, you had to know what to do. So at the end of his life, when he finishes the presidency, he struggles with what to do, and he writes two wills. And as we all know, he goes out on a trek around his property, comes back with a cold, very ill, and they're doing the bleeding with him, and he's getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And he says to Martha, bring me my estate plans. And he reads both of them, and he throws one into the fire, and the other one becomes the estate plan. Now, He made a drafting mistake, because when you read the estate plan, he basically says, upon Martha's death, you can free my slaves. But George didn't think about what did that actually mean, right? And I run into this a lot in financial planning. You have to really talk through estate planning decisions. And if you're Martha, you realize your death is the only thing keeping these people from freedom, you're a little afraid for your life. And by the way, Abigail Adams, who was not a slaveholder and very anti-slavery, goes to visit Martha. And Abigail writes a friend, says, Martha's terrified. Of course she is, right? But, you know, look, they're slave owners. This is, they're not exactly right in that. But Martha decides she's going to do a writ of manumission and free the slaves, which she does. And that relieves all this tension. And she doesn't live much longer after Washington. She's so brokenhearted. But Washington is a great example of somebody who was always strong with money. And just one little error could have undermined the whole thing. And so really talking about things and thinking through their impact is incredibly important.
In case you can't tell, our guest today, Megan Gorman, is quite a storyteller. We've had a wonderful time speaking with her. The book, All the President's Money, How the Men Who Governed America Governed Their Money. Thanks for spending time with us.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.